The last week or 9 days or so, I was teaching a retreat. And there was a person in the retreat who said something to me, very simple, that somehow resonated, partly, or kind of stayed with me in my mind for a while, and partly stayed with me because of the Dharma talk that was given on Friday evening of the retreat. And this person had known Krishnamurti for many, many years, and I think he had been kind of a close friend, perhaps, or friend, or someone who worked with Krishnamurti for many, many years. So knew the man very well. And Krishnamurti was one of the great spiritual teachers of the 20th century. Really a remarkable man, remarkable teaching. And Krishnamurti in some ways opened the door for me to Buddhism, because when I was about 19, maybe 18, I picked up a book by Krishnamurti called, I believe it was called Beyond Violence. And in that book, he talked about anger a little bit. And he talked about the practice of paying attention to the anger. And that was kind of the beginning of this idea that you could pay attention. That was a useful thing. So this person had known Krishnamurti for many years, and he said, in the course of our conversation about Krishnamurti, that Krishnamurti had only said things if he was asked. If he wasn't asked, he didn't say anything. And after he died, they kind of regretted they hadn't asked him more. And this idea of only speaking when asked kind of stayed with me a little for a while. So the Dharma talk on Friday at the retreat was about three topics that were considered, were presented as being very intimately related and supportive of each other in the same way that the pyramid is kind of all elements are related. And the three elements are solitude, listening, and speaking. And the idea is that solitude is the base of the pyramid, and listening is kind of halfway up. The top of the pyramid, the very peak, I guess, would be speaking. And if you have it in that proportion, you know, then you have speaking in a balanced way. But if you turn the proportions upside down, I guess, or you have speaking first, you know, the pyramid upside down, you try to focus on speaking first, and then it's easy to topple over. So solitude, the capacity for solitude, is a foundation for the capacity to listen, and listening then a capacity for the capacity to speak. And I gave a little story of my early life, where I had the first time that I really spent time alone for an extended period of time. And I was left alone on a dairy farm in Norway for a week when I was 21, and to take care of the farm while the two farmers, the husband and wife, left for vacation. And I wasn't planning to be alone, but it was a quite rural farm, far up a valley, end of a road. And the only person who I saw during the course of the week was, I think once I saw the mail carrier come up the road. Otherwise, I didn't see anybody. And I had a lovely time with what I call my five girlfriends. Farmers can be polygamous. You know, I had lovely five cows that I took care of. And but in the course of staying alone, you're not talking to anybody, not engaging in social conversation, what I noticed in the course of the week was my mind got calmer and stiller. And my perception got more and more acute. And I noticed externally that if I looked at things, things seemed really sharp, like highlighted, like really clear, like it sparkled in the way that I'd never kind of almost never seen before in my life. That's how clear, the kind of clarity things can have. And what surprised me the most was how acutely aware I became of my own thoughts. And it was like they were highlighted. It felt really special, kind of unique, kind of to have my thoughts kind of so clearly seen, just like, you know, little. And I felt very, in a sense, intimate, both with the world around me and with myself. It felt very satisfying, very wonderful. And then after a week, my friends came back. And very quickly, that intimacy, that stillness, that calmness that I had disappeared. And when it disappeared, it became my question or my quest for many years in my so-called spiritual life, was to discover how to be alone with other people. I suppose I could have thought, you know, well, that was great. I think I'll become a hermit. But that didn't occur to me because I just took for granted that I was going to be involved in society. So the question was, how can I have this sense of intimacy and perception, acute perception and presence, sense of independence, sense of, this sense of integrity that came when I was alone. How can I have it together with others? Where I found it so hard to do that. So that for many years, then that was kind of like behind my practice and my exploration of practice and how to apply practice in daily life was how to discover that interface and be that way. And I feel very grateful to my Buddhist practice, meditation practice, in helping me cultivate what I hopefully call a healthy sense of solitude, a capacity to abide not only independent in a certain way, but independent but also deeply at home, here, in myself, in this place. And you understand the value of that much more, I think, if you understand the way we get pulled out of that home or that kind of healthy solitude into social relationships, for example. One of the ways that I was tend to be pulled off into social relationships, often get caught by it, was a tremendous drive I used to have to be liked. Now, it's okay to want to be liked. I think it's a normal kind of thing. But you can be neurotic about it. And you can go through a tremendous amount of social gymnastics in order to try to make sure that people like you. And I did it until I was so sick of it. Until it was so painful to go through this gymnastics. And only when it was really painful could I see it well enough to say, this is crazy. And then slowly I could kind of release the grip of it. But that concern to be liked, or how, to be concerned about how people see me, is a way of being pulled out of oneself, out of being in touch with this kind of solitude, this kind of healthy sense of being oneself or being in oneself. If we can use that language. So there's, you know, all kinds of fears that come into play when we're involved socially with people. There's all kinds of ambitions and desires and all kinds of ways in which we kind of are concerned about our social relationships. And if you kind of go along with my vocabulary a little bit, kind of give me a little bit freedom to kind of... I think it's useful to distinguish between what can be called the social self or the relational self and maybe what we can call the independent self. The relational self is that idea of who you are, that sense of self that we have, that we form in relationship to other people. And it's really an essential, very important kind of way of being in the world is to understand how we are in relationship with other people, how we affect other people, how other people affect us, how we project on other people or how we see them and the views we have. There's a tremendous amount of things that goes on in our social world. It's a very important part of it. And if some of that relational part of self, selfing, doesn't happen appropriately as children, then children grow up kind of a little bit off, a little bit difficult for them. So it's a very important part of who we are. If a person thinks that all they are is the social self, the relational self, then the adult is in trouble. Because the relational self is never going to be stable. It's not a fixed thing. you don't kind of look for your true self and find it in a relational self, who you are in relationship to the world, because that's going to change and shift over a lifetime and over time and over different people. I found it fascinating when I was younger to notice how I was different with different friends. Have you seen that? Notice that, some of you? It was kind of fascinating to see, you know, it's kind of like, and then some people I know like to bring friends together who come from different parts of their life, and it's kind of like odd. And you don't know how to be anymore because you're supposed to be one way with one person. And I think some of that's normal. And then if some of you maybe have been to different spent time, enough time in different countries and cultures to know how people are different in different languages. I mean, not just different cultures of people, but like myself. I grew up some in Norway, some in Italy, and some in the United States. And I'm different. I was different in each of those cultures. So things I could speak in Italian, I couldn't speak in English. And ways of being that I felt inside that I was kind of different. And I've noticed that with other people who've kind of been bicultural or something, that they seem almost to have a little bit different personality depending on the culture that they are speaking through at that given time. So the relational self is something which is fluid and changeable, and it's contingent, it's conditional, something that comes together because of causes and conditions. There's nothing that's inherently who we are in some deep, fundamental way in the relational self. But there is another kind of self that Buddhists are reluctant to call a self. So we don't want to use the language too strongly or too firmly, but the idea that there is a way of being in the world where we're deeply at rest. And Rainbow, can you go with him, please? Actually, maybe Mark, would you please? We had one incident before with him, so just abused. To the relational self, you know, we care about each other. Mm-hmm. And but there's that place of being at home with oneself, or being at home or at rest or at peace, where that peace is not dependent on what goes on around us or the relationships we have with people around us. And I think a lot of what Buddhist practice is pointing to, or meditation practice is pointing to, is that possibility of discovering a kind of a peace, a kind of a well-being, a kind of rest that is not contingent upon the external world being any particular way or being in relationship to anybody. And now, it's quite interesting when people meditate, especially like on retreat, you notice this, how many of our relationships we bring with us. And we're still kind of working out the relational sphere, you know, for 2 days or 3 days on retreat. How long does it last? For some people. When I went, I did an 8-month retreat once in Burma. And 8 months are basically in silence. And after about 2 months on the retreat, I was pretty still, pretty concentrated. And I noticed that I had all these thoughts still that kind of came up and grabbed me here and there about the San Francisco Zen Center, which was a community I had lived in for many years. And many of this had my main teachers were from Zen Center, and I worked there. And I had all these thoughts. I was having conversations with people and concerned about how some of the teachers saw me. You know, I was in Burma. They couldn't see me. And I was interested about, you know, my job promotion at Zen Center. If I go back there, maybe I can be like, get this job and that job, you know, and you know, move up through the ranks kind of thing. And I just couldn't believe it. And here I was in Burma, I was on retreat, and how insidious these subtle thoughts, preoccupations with this relational self was still operating there. And so I got to see it. And in my situation, I made a vow that I wouldn't go back to Zen Center until I got Zen Center out of my mind. Because I wasn't free as long as it was there. So sometimes in meditation or in other situations like that, we can start seeing You know, how much the relationship has really gripped the mind, holding us tightly. And part of what meditation can do is begin to relax that grip and soften it, and eventually maybe even let go of it entirely, that concern. If you let go enough, to find some very deep abiding, some deep peace, some deep way of settled way, where what Buddhists will say, you have no concern about self at all. Selfing is not going on at all. So to have that kind of rest and that kind of peace, to be able to rest that way, then is a marvelous condition for being able to listen carefully. Because then you can listen without an agenda. But if you have the relational self operating big time, then it's all too easy to kind of be concerned about what people are saying and thinking, what you're saying and doing, and projecting and looking this way and that. But if you're deeply at rest, I think a lot of the projections that we have and transferences that goes on in conversation tends to fall away and relax. So we have no agenda, so we can listen more carefully, listen deeply to what's going on. There's a beautiful quote by Rilke. He says, he takes it as the most important task between two people to protect each other's solitude. And I think it's a great quote. And he said something like, it's the nature of the indifference of the crowd for the individual to be lost, to lose our solitude. So to listen deeply in such a way that we are at peace, so that the other person can be themselves fully at peace, that they're not having to negotiate or through your agendas that you have in the conversation. They're meeting someone who's, you know, leaving them alone so they can be who they are. It's said sometimes one of the best, biggest gifts you can give someone is let them be who they are. So to listen. So being able to not have an agenda allows listening. And listening is very important. Listening can be to oneself, can listen more deeply to yourself, and you can listen to others. And I think listening to others is supported by being able to listen to oneself at the same time. There's an art to tracking and paying attention to what's going on here as you speak, the thoughts you have, the reactions you have, the motivations you have, and then to track those as you're listening so that you know where you come from when you get ready to speak. Reminds me of stories told often from the Ramayana. It's the story of the god Rama traveling through the forest in India with companions. And Rama hears a faint voice, really faint voice, and he listens carefully. And the voice is very quietly saying, "Rama, Rama, Rama." And he asks his companions if they're hearing the voice. And they say, "No, we hear nothing." And so he kind of follows, you know, the voice, kind of goes towards the voice. And then he comes to this big boulder. And that big boulder is, from inside the boulder comes this voice saying, "Rama," calling him, "Rama," calling him. And so he lays his hands on top of the boulder. At which point the boulder, I forget how the story goes, but either breaks open or dissolves or transforms. And this woman emerges from inside. And she thanks him. And she says, "Oh, a long, 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 long time ago, I was somehow bewitched and was stuck in this boulder until you could come along, or someone could come along who could hear me calling them and offer their, you know, and somehow break the spell." So he was able to listen. But part of the value for me in that story is the name of the woman is Alaya. And Alaya in Sanskrit means home. Like Himalaya means snow home. So, you know, the home is calling, and it's calling very faintly. It's hard to hear. And it's very shy. It's very hard to hear that place of rest and peace inside of us. It's calling us, "Please come." And it takes a lot of careful listening to be able to listen, in a sense, or sense your way into that place of being deeply at peace and home with oneself. If you're involved in a lot of busy life, if you're involved, caught up in the social world, too much, you're not going to be able to listen. And part of the reason to meditate, part of the reason to spend time alone in the wilderness or, you know, just alone anywhere, and to have kind of space, sacred leisure, is so you can start making space in your mind to listen deeply to the home, the alaya, which perhaps is calling for you. There's also listening then to others. And I'm fond of the saying, which is supposed to have been attributed to Epicurus, is that how you say it? The ancient Greek philosopher, who said, God gave us two ears and one mouth so we could listen twice as much as we speak. And so to listen carefully. And one of the ways of listening in conversation, so you're not just passive, is to ask questions. You know, be interested in what the person's saying and kind of draw them out. I find it fascinating. Often I learn so much that way by asking questions. And I notice in myself sometimes that when I'm in a conversation that I'm listening and there's an impulse to speak. Sometimes even wanting to interrupt the person. And then it's very interesting to pay attention, to listen, to what that impulse is about. What's that sense of urgency? What's the sense of what's the compelling feeling? Why is this compelling feeling? You feel like you need to say something. My guess is half the time that you feel a compelling need to interrupt someone, you've been caught in that relational self. And that's really what's motivating the desire to speak. So to spend time listening, both to listen to the other person well, but also as a mindfulness exercise to learn about yourself well. You learn a lot about yourself by not speaking. You also save yourself a lot of grief. Here's a quote from Mahatma Gandhi. My hesitancy in speech, which was once an annoyance, is now a pleasure. It takes a while to get the hang of this. You know. So my hesitancy in speech, which was once an annoyance, is now a pleasure. Its greatest benefit has been that it has taught me the economy of words. I have naturally formed that habit of restraining my thoughts, and I can now give myself the certificate that a thoughtless word hardly ever escapes my tongue or my pen. I do not recollect ever having to regret anything in my speech or writing. I have been spared many a mishap and a waste of time. Experience has taught me that silence is part of the spiritual discipline of the seeker of truth. Proneness to exaggerate, to suppress or modify the truth, wittingly or unwittingly, is a natural weakness of people, and silence is necessary in order to surmount it. A person of few words will rarely be thoughtless in his or her speech. She or he will measure every word. So the top of the pyramid then is speaking. And some people counsel, measure your words, don't speak too much. And I don't know if that's necessarily to be an ascetic around speech. I think it's lovely to have, you know, a coffee shop talk. Sometimes it's really fun to sit over a coffee table and just kind of go back and forth and get excited and talk about a topic and explore and see what happens. But mindfulness of speech, being careful with our speech. The Buddha gave four different guidelines in different times, but four guidelines for when we should speak and how to be careful with our speech. And some of you might wonder, why in the world should you? And it's been said that most people choose their clothes more carefully than the words they speak. Maybe it should be reversed. But so four criteria for when to speak. The first is only speak if what you're going to say is truthful. The second, only if it's kind. The third is only if it is useful. And the fourth is only if it helps bring people together or create concord or create harmony. So if what you're going to say is going to be divisive, then maybe you should not say it and see if you can say what you need to say in a way that's not divisive. If what you're going to say is not going to be heard, no one's going to hear it, you know, then don't waste your breath. Sometimes, you know, we feel like we have some conflict with someone, but the other person's not capable of hearing. Maybe you should just not deal with it if they're not capable of hearing what needs to be heard. Is it useful? And then, you know, is it kind? And kind doesn't mean kind of sugary kind or romantically kind. Sometimes, you know, there's, you know, they say tough compassion or tough kindness. But is it kind? Is it your intention in speaking one of kindness? And then the first one, is it truthful? Is it really what's, you know, going on? If it's not one of those four things, maybe you're better off not talking, being silent. To investigate and look at your speech from those four criteria. I found it myself to be phenomenally powerful to look at what motivates what I speak. I believe that it's so powerful that if someone really was careful with it, and it's very hard to be careful, it's hard for me to be careful around this, but the more careful you can do this, the more benefit you get. But you're very careful to notice why you're saying what you're going to say. Not the surface reason, but why you're saying what you're going to say. It'll provide you one of the best windows you have into how you tick, what goes on inside. One of the royal roads to the unconscious. And so to take the opportunity of your speaking or your impulse to speak to try to understand yourself better, as opposed to speaking and losing yourself in the speech. I've known so many people who have had out-of-the-body experiences while they were speaking. But they didn't know it. You know, if you have an out-of-the-body experience, it'd be nice if you had a nice trip someplace, but, you know, they're just kind of lost in their words. Not in their body. So I think a number of things I've said today are hopefully something that will interest you to experiment a little bit with. Experiment with cultivating solitude, or if you can't cultivate a lot of solitude, at least practice a little bit of silence. See what happens with silence in your life, a little bit more. Maybe take a week or a day or an hour where you can intentionally take more silence or more solitude and see what happens. Another thing you might be interested in trying is listening more and exploring the world of listening. Maybe take one day where you're just going to listen, you know, turn the table upside down and, you know, or whatever. Just listen as much as you possibly can. Don't contribute anything unless you're asked. And another thing you might be interested in doing is experimenting with speech. Experimenting with maybe one of those four criteria at different times. Just explore the area of truthfulness, explore the area of kindness, or of usefulness, or of concord. I find it very interesting, this idea of concord, to speak in such a way that people feel more connected to you, even when you're in conflict, even when they hate you. Can you talk in such a way that somehow, you know, you feel more closer, rather than continuing the division? And then I'll offer you one more interesting exercise that you might try, maybe for one day, if you can manage. And that is, spend a day where you don't talk about anybody who's not present. And then pay attention to your impulse. Whenever you want to talk about someone who's not present, try to understand why and what and what's going on for you. And a lot of talking about other people who are not present is innocent enough, is fine. But sometimes it's kind of not so fine. Gossip and rumors and all kinds of things go on in talking about a third party who's not present. But you might take one day, just one day of your life, And you might warn all your friends ahead of time. For this day, I'm not going to talk about anybody who's not present. And then see what happens when you do that. Learn from that. So those are my thoughts for this evening. And we have a little bit of time if any of you would like to ask a question or comments or your own, talk a little bit about your own experience of working with any of these three areas. Yes? At the very beginning of the talk, I said someone asked me a question. Is that what I said? So long ago, it was like 40 minutes ago. Krishnamurti. Oh, I had this conversation with a man who had told me about his experience with Krishnamurti, and that Krishnamurti didn't speak unless he was asked a question first. So there was a lot of things people wanted to know after he passed away, but they'd forgotten to ask him. But they didn't encourage them to ask him. And he didn't volunteer, unless he was asked, frankly. Maybe that's... Yes? Oh, we should be past this. I shouldn't be holding it. Is it turned on? Is it a little switch?
I'm curious about how you have dealt with, you were talking about sort of being liked by other people. Yeah, how have you dealt with that? What has helped you deal with that? With the idea of, wanting to be liked?
A number of things have helped. I mean, one of the things that helped was seeing it really clearly. And I only saw it so clearly when it got painful. And so there's benefits in suffering. You know, seeing something so clearly, you really have to see it. You have to admit it's there. And sometimes it's easy to admit something's not there, or, you know, pretend it's not there, or not even know it's there, if it's not painful. When it starts getting painful, we see it. So that was actually very helpful for me. That's what really caused me to take it seriously and look at it. Another thing that helped was sitting a lot of meditation. At the time in my life when I really was confronting this, I was living in a monastery. And so we were doing a lot of meditation. So I was going in and out and in and out of sitting quietly and going back in relationship and coming back and sitting. So in the sitting, I was able to let go of so many things. And then the state of letting go, I was able to go back and explore the world of relationship and see it come up again. And, you know, in a course of a day, I went back and forth a number of times. And so meditation for me was very valuable. And it's still valuable for me that to stay centered and balanced in myself. I see what's going on much better. Another thing which has been helpful is beginning to address or being able to identify or see some of the things that are behind the desire to be liked. There was a level of fear, a level of insecurity that I carried with me. And so be able to see that fear and insecurity was actually more useful than seeing the desire to be liked. And so being able to see that and then working with that and sitting with that and practicing with that with my practice. I mostly did this through meditation practice because I was mostly, that's where, you know, I was in monasteries and stuff. And other people, sometimes will do it in therapy and other places. So those are some of the things, simple things.
Any suggestions on how to maintain mindfulness when relating to difficult people?
How to maintain mindfulness when relating to difficult people? Sometimes it's easier when it's difficult people. Sometimes, I know for me, when I'm most challenged, that's when I better, I kind of get revved up a little bit. To be like, this is important, I better pay attention here. As I get kind of aroused, so that's so I often use that as a cue. I pay attention to my body and my feelings, and if I'm getting aroused or having a lot of reactivity, then that's a time to stop and pay attention, and that helps. I find asking questions very helpful. Sometimes difficult people, depends on the difficulty people are bringing, but sometimes showing interest in people and asking questions can disarm difficult people. When I was thinking about the monastery a lot, but when I was at Zen Center for a period of time, I was like the point person for original people who came visiting. And there are some people who have very original minds, and they kind of wander off the street. They're kind of homeless or this and that, and so somehow they always find me to kind of talk to these original people, and mostly I found just showing an interest in them and being kind to them and trying to understand what they needed and what they wanted was helpful. What do you find most difficult about difficult people? It's such a huge topic, so I'm kind of just fishing around. Mm-hmm. But maybe if you can give us something more specific.
I suppose what's difficult is when you make a big effort and overextended time and it's still.
Okay, well, I'll tell you this the wonderful story of Mulla Nazaruddin. Mulla was this great Islamic mullah, clergy, and who was very wise. All these wisdoms, there are a lot of stories, Mulla Nazaruddin stories, and they're kind of funny, some of them. And Mulla had a garden, and he had a problem with dandelion. There were weeds in his garden, and they just kept coming back and taking over his garden. He tried everything. He went to all these gardeners and garden shops and books and tried all the different advice, and nothing seemed to work. He always had these weeds in his garden, these dandelions. And so finally he went to the king's gardener, and he was supposed to be the greatest gardener in the whole kingdom. And so he went to the great expert, went to the king's gardener, the old wise man who'd been gardening for 80 years or something. And he explained the situation to the king's gardener about how everything he tried, all the different things he'd done, and he still couldn't get rid of these dandelions. And so the king's gardener was quiet a little bit and then finally said, "Well, in that case, I suggest that you love the dandelions." So, if you try it a lot with these difficult people, you might see if you can shift your perspective of what you're trying to do. If you're trying too hard or trying a lot and trying to change the relationship or change them or trying to fix it, occasionally it's the wrong approach. And sometimes it even is counterproductive because people pick up that you're trying to fix something. And what's most needed or what's maybe most effective sometimes is your kindness and acceptance of them. That sometimes works. But people are so different and circumstances are so different and I feel reluctant to... But what other people have found? I trust that a few of you at least have had difficult people in your lives and some experience. What have you found useful? So listening to the person is useful.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's kind of letting the person be as difficult as they are and just accepting it. It's changing my relationship with how I relate to them and saying, well, that's just how they are. That's what it's worked for me.
That's the best thing, yeah. In the back.
For me, most often when I perceive someone as difficult, there's something that I'm wanting for myself. That's so there's some kind of self-motivation in it. If I can recognize that, then often my perception of them shifts.
Beautiful. Thank you. All the way in the back.
Hello. I had a very difficult relationship with a boss, and it was carrying on after I'd retired a number of years. It was still, it would come up, and I couldn't even say the name without feeling it. And finally, I realized, well, a friend of mine married a woman who was had five horses, and he didn't know anything about horses. And this boss of mine also had horses. So I decided I will call and ask her to educate me on horses. Just, I needed to take an initiative. I needed to ask her for something. And so I did, and she told me a couple things about horses, which I then relayed, and I've never had that feeling about her since. It was to take an initiative and admit that she could help me to myself. Uh-huh. And it just, it was beautiful. Really.
Well, maybe it's enough. It's 9 o'clock. And I don't want to become your difficult person for the evening if I just go on and on. So thank you for listening. And it's, you know, a little bit of a paradox or odd for me to talk about the importance of listening and being quiet. And all I do all evening is go on and on and on. Thank you.